Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Schatz, wir müssen los zu meiner Mutter.
Oh, ich kann leider nicht mit. Der Mähroboter mäht immer noch nicht, wo er soll.
Immer findest du eine Ausrede.
Ja, nein, das ist nicht so leicht.
Sonst läuft bei dir doch auch alles automatisch.
Weniger Ausreden, mehr Automatisierung. Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Stimme deinen Husqvarna-Mähroboter durch individuelle Installation exakt auf deine Anforderungen ab. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.
Wusstest du, dass TK Maxx immer die besten Markendeals hat? Duftkerzen für alle, Sportoutfits, stylische Pieces für dein Zuhause, Designer-Handtasche, check, check, check. Bei TK Maxx findest du große Marken zu unglaublichen Preisen. Psst. Im Onlineshop auf tkmaxx.de kannst du rund um die Uhr die besten Markendeals shoppen. TK Maxx, immer der bessere Deal im Store und online.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga in Nairobi, and here's what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. It's been found that the very addictive drug Kush is 100 times more potent than heroin.
This is enough for us to put us into action. We will intensify whatever interventions we have been doing whilst we await for confirmatory tests. But these are indications that this is a problem for the country, and we'll do everything possible as a country to make sure that we mitigate the negative effects of this drug use in Sierra Leone.
And what potential does artificial intelligence have to help African farmers? We'll hear from one who won an award. It's Monday, June 17th. First, we go to South Sudan, where people were shocked after a protest at the University of Juba turned violent. The demonstrators were all female students and were protesting a hike in their hostel fees. But not long after, pictures of these young women emerged on various platforms, showing that they had been severely beaten by police. Some women were arrested. But this is much deeper than a protest over hostel fees. There's a deeper prejudice against women at play. To get a better sense of these underlying issues, I turn to Jacqueline Nasiwa, a human rights defender and director of the Center for Inclusive Governance, Peace and Justice in South Sudan. I began by asking her what her reaction was to what had happened.
I think the first time I heard about it, someone was telling me, oh, there are students whose teeth are broken and others injured from the University of Juba. And I was like, what happened? I didn't know the level. But when they shared the photos with me, first my reaction was really, I was so angry, very, very angry, because you can't use that excessive force on women and also on students, you know, who are struggling to be where they are. And the police brutality, I think, is very sad, shameful, and annoying at the same time.
Mm. And has this sort of incident happened before where there are injuries like what you've been describing, really awful events?
I think the level of brutality against girls and women is not something new. I remember initially there was this violence used against women for dressing maybe in trousers or in clothes that the police think are inappropriate. And I think one of it was in Bor, where even the girls and the women were stripped of their clothing and they were asked to go and change. And that scene was not good. In Juba also, girls were stripped of their jean trousers because they were wearing jean, which were said by the police to be tied and showing off and all this. So this level of brutality targeting women and girls is not something new. And I think the use of force to me is what is really disheartening, because you can't use guns to hit women. You can't use knives or sticks to hit women the way we have seen. And I think there is this defense like, oh, these girls were having sticks, but we have not seen an injured police. You know, we have not seen an injured police. We only see the injured girls. And you can't be using gun to fight people who are not having guns. There should be tear gas if there is a protest or whatever. But also the right of freedom of expression, association and protest is in our constitution. So if these students are protesting, and then they need to sit down and ask, why are they protesting? Probably it is policy and all this. But from what we are hearing is that they have not paid their hostel fees and all these kinds of excuses that are given. Yeah.
Now, talking about that right to protest being in the constitution, then how often do we see people in South Sudan exercise that? Are they allowed to protest, or do we see people, you know, avoiding what you'd call critiquing or criticizing the authority?
You know, this freedom of expression and the freedom of peaceful protest is not even respected, despite that is in our constitution. The moment you talked of going for peaceful protest, and then you see the reaction of the forces coming with all their guns and all this to disperse a protest which is to be peaceful. So this intolerance to peaceful protest, freedom of assembly and association is something that needs to be addressed, because we have it in our constitution and we also have it in our international obligations under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the African Charter on People's Rights. So all these are in the law, but they are not respected. Exercising it by citizens and by an armed group is rejected outrightly. So I'm not surprised that the police use that excessive force to disperse girls who are protesting in front of their hostel.
So they were protesting in front of their hostels, and they were protesting over hostel fees. They all happened to be female students or women. Do you think there's an element of gender prejudice then, given the profile of the people that were protesting and the kind of response they got from the police?
I followed some discussions online, and there's that element of gender where even some men and boys are saying, oh, these girls are stubborn. What are vehicles doing in front of their hostels? Why are they dressed the way they are dressed? You know, all these kinds of gender stereotype came up. But what I would say is that if it is maybe a man protesting or whatever protesting, will they still use that brutality against the boys? And knowing that women are vulnerable in this country, you can't use this force. These girls are struggling where even education is a challenge. If you look at the number of enrollment of girls to the university, you can say thank you to these girls who have persistently pursued their education to reach a university. And the economic challenges they go through, maybe nobody can understand the pain, you know, for a girl in this country to be able to reach to a university. You are struggling, your parents are struggling. Probably some of them even had no parents. They are maybe doing other businesses, like maybe selling tea or whatever, to be in the university. And today, if they don't have it, what could be the affirmative action from the government to support these girls? The affirmative action should be seen also in the universities, where girls who are vulnerable and cannot pay for their school fees, the government should be able to supplement, you know, pay half and the students pay half. Because these are brilliant girls who are able to reach the university, but chasing them out because they cannot pay the fee is not helping us in addressing the illiteracy rate among the girls and women of this country.
Right. So you talked about there being criticism of the protest and women protesting in general, taking the line of how they are dressed or how they look. What is the reaction of the society in general when events like this happen? What do people tend to say, events where women are seen to be agitating for something they believe is their rights?
They don't look at why these women are protesting, but they look at issues to do with behaviors. As I said, they were like, oh, these girls, even in the hostel, what are they doing there? Men come to the hostel, blaming them, you know. I think this also calls for reform of the hostel management and probably policy in this country. Some hostels even don't deserve to be hostels for students. They are open space, there is no security, there is no provision of safety measures, the accommodation is poor. So demanding for money for that should also be seen in the quality of the services that will be given to the students. Always looking at the weakness of the victim rather than why the crime has happened against the victim is what people do. We have seen situations where victims are blamed, especially when it relates to GBV. You know, we have seen the recent incident where an inmate got pregnant in the prison, and instead of looking at who impregnated her, who abused her, they are saying like she's a criminal of 1, 2, 3. So when it comes to issues of women and gender issues relating to rights of women, always there is stigma and there is blaming the victim rather than seeing why is the victim taking this course. And they leave out the reasons why the woman is demanding for her rights, but looking at what type of a woman is that, who is that woman, and who are these women?
And in closing then, on the same line of thought, Jacqueline, would you say that women are becoming more aware of their rights and willing to speak about them?
I think these women, they are courageous to demand for their rights. And women are starting to realize, yes, they have rights in the Constitution and all this, but not many women know this right. And that means that we have to continuously empower women to stand up and to raise their voice and to demand for their rights to be respected and for them to be protected.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jacqueline Nasiwa. Have a good day.
All right, thank you.
That's Jacqueline Nasiwa from the Center for Inclusive Governance, Peace and Justice in South Sudan. We contacted South Sudan's National Police spokesperson to offer a chance to tell us their side of the story, but we've not yet had a response. Some of you will remember this story. In April this year, Sierra Leone's president declared a national emergency over rampant drug use. The problem? Kush, a psychoactive blend of addictive substances that has been prevalent in the country for years. President Julius Maada Bio at the time called the drug a death trap and said it posed an existential crisis. Groups of mostly young men sitting on street corners with limbs swollen by kush abuse became a common sight in the country, so a national task force was set up to help probe the effects of this harmful drug. Professor Fodesa is the chairman of the task force. I called him up earlier today. Professor Sir, thank you for joining us on Focus on Africa. So for people that may not have heard about kush, what is it? What can you tell us about it?
Well, for us in Sierra Leone, we became aware of kush sometime last year, and we don't know the composition, but it's something that is sold within the streets of Freetown, having adverse consequences. The only light that we have, because there are various reports that is made up of formaldehyde, acetone, but the first indication that we had of its composition was very recently when the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crimes came and worked with our local partners here and found out that indeed it had a synthetic cannabinoid together with nitrazine.
In April this year, the president of Sierra Leone declared a national emergency against kush. Remind us why he did that and broadly tell us why kush is such a national problem.
From last year to now, it was observed that there is an increase in the number of admissions way back to 2022. At the psychiatric hospital alone, we found out that the number of people admitted for drug and substance abuse actually increased by over 1,000%. Even on the streets, we found people presenting in abnormal ways, dying on the streets. So indeed, in April this year, the president thought it fit that he must establish a task force that should coordinates the efforts of all those people working in the space of drug and substance abuse. And he declared that a national emergency in April and appointed me as national coordinator.
And the initiative that you're talking about, the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime, so those are some of the partners you're working with among other organizations as well as a country. Tell us why this partnership is needed in the work that you are doing and what you've managed to do so far from April.
Well, in Sierra Leone, for us, you know, currently we do not have the capacity to test the chemical composition of kush. And with this initiative, preliminary analysis was done in country. They came with their equipment. We do not have that capacity currently in country, though we are working with partners to make sure that that is realized in Sierra Leone. So it was very necessary for this organization to actually do the preliminary testing. It's preliminary because these samples have to be shipped out again for confirmatory testing. We are working on that.
We've covered this story for a while, and we know this substance called kush is very addictive. Remind us what the consequences of consuming these drugs are.
From observation, the presentation of people, when they take this drug, they behave like zombies. You see somebody standing, but he's asleep. People dying on the streets, you know, people who are in school, people are in universities, when they get hooked to this, they drop out of school and university. A number of people have actually been rehabilitated and then they are now being sent back to their school. Some have now gone back to university. So it is indeed a problem.
And so you've done some initial testing on this substance. Could you talk us through the results, what you found in kush and how dangerous it is?
it was found that the substance contained synthetic cannabinoids and nitrazines. Three categories of this compound in this analysis. One category was found to have only the synthetic cannabinoid as the primary ingredient, and the second category was synthetic cannabinoid and nitrazine as primary ingredients, and the third category was nitrazine as the primary ingredient. 83% of the samples tested in Freetown were found to have nitrazine.
That component, that nitrazine, is 100 times more potent than heroin. That's shocking.
It's shocking, yeah. I mean, we all know, I mean, if you go, this is a drug that was worked upon, I mean, in the 40s or 50s, but unfortunately, it was never released in the market as a substitute for morphine. But over the years now, we just found that how it got to the market, we don't know. So that also needs to be traced. But from the literature, we know it can be 100 times more potent than heroin and even 10 times more potent than fentanyl.
So these are initial findings. How significant are they?
As a country, we will not wait for the confirmatory test. This is enough for us to put us into action. We will intensify whatever interventions we have been doing whilst we await for confirmatory test. But these are indications that this is a problem for the country, and we'll do everything possible as a country to make sure that we mitigate the negative effects of this drug used in Sierra Leone.
Could you tell me what you're doing or what you will start to do with these results, and what kind of immediate action, like you're saying, what kind of action will it be?
As a task force, we are working on five pillars. The first one is to increase community awareness, to explain to people the harmful effect of the results. We tell them that this is the active ingredient of this drug and how dangerous it is. We're also establishing treatment centers, community care centers. We are also intensifying the law drug enforcement activity, that is, rogues who are bringing this drug into the country will be chased and arrested, and that is ongoing. We want this response to be owned by the communities. We make sure that we establish treatment centers or rehab centers within the community, and then now have our own oversight team moving to communities to work with them, because the people trust this caregiver. There are so many private caregivers within the community, and they do trust them. So we are not criminalizing them, but we have to work with them to make sure that they improve their processes on how they handle these people.
This is also a regional problem. We've seen a Kush problem in Liberia, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Senegal, basically pretty much all your neighbors. Are you working together to address this and sharing ideas in terms of combating this?
We have not started, but with the information that we are getting, that it is indeed a problem, not only in Sierra Leone, but in the sub-region, I think we have to start that initiative to make sure that we work alone, because it's easy. The borders are porous. People come with the drugs from Liberia, from Guinea, and even from as far as Senegal. So I think it's an effort that we have to activate to make sure that we work as a sub-region.
What happens next in terms of more scientific work around this and more sort of measures to combat this? What happens next beside what you already told us?
We have 96 samples now ready to be shipped to a lab in Madrid, Spain. And we are also in discussion with the US CDC. We'll be sending an expert to Sierra Leone to work with us to make sure that more samples are collected, not only in Freetown, but in the entire country, to make sure that we do analysis, because it is possible. These preliminary results, as I said, most of the samples were collected in Freetown. It is possible that the composition of the Kush in the north might be different from that in the south, different from that in the western area. So more samples are to be collected and tested, not only preliminary, but to make sure that we have confirmatory testing. Continue to work with partners. So we are open. It's a country that needs help. Anybody that can come to make sure that we solve this problem.
Thank you, Professor, for your time.
Thank you.
Professor Fode Sarr. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Let's talk about an innovation that could transform food security in Africa. Recently, Esther Kimani from Kenya received an award from the Royal Academy of Engineering for her innovation. Esther developed a solar-powered tool that utilizes AI and machine learning-enabled cameras to detect and identify agricultural pests and diseases. This invention earned her Africa's largest prize for engineering innovation, making her the third woman and the second Kenyan to win the Africa Prize, along with a £50,000 reward. This is Esther speaking shortly after her name was called.
I feel so excited when they just said the third female. I couldn't breathe. I just couldn't breathe for a moment there.
What does this mean to you? Yeah, what does this mean to you?
It's a great encouragement for the work that we are doing. Bearing in mind that Esther is just one person. There's a team behind me that has made this possible. And I'm so grateful to them as well. My family has supported me so far. I'm so grateful. I'm lost for words.
And what's your message for young innovators out there, like yourself?
I'd like to encourage entrepreneurs out there. It's hard. There are nights that are lonely. There are times you'll spend long hours in the office and no one will see that. But it will pay off. It will pay off. Let's remember the vision and why we're waking up every morning to go to that office. There are people who are looking up to us, those who've employed. And generations to come are also looking up to us. So I hope they'll be encouraged to keep up with what they do.
Currently, over 20% of people in Africa are undernourished, with food security remaining a critical issue across the continent. Climate change has made farming increasingly unpredictable, and warmer temperatures have accelerated pest reproduction, further complicating the situation. Farmers and innovators alike are seeking solutions. Hakim Balirayne is a farmer in Uganda, and the chairperson of the Eastern and Southern Africa Farmers Federation. As a small-scale farmer, he confronts these challenges daily. Coming from a family of small-scale farmers myself, I empathize with their struggles. We discussed how AI can transform farming and bring substantial benefits to African farmers.
In my own opinion, this should have been a good approach to elevate, to fasten the way we identify pests and diseases in our farms, our crops, our livestock. However, according to the infrastructure and utilities we have as small-scale farmers, there are quite a lot of hurdles which can hinder that good technology to help the farmers do so. Because even the current use of pesticides, which are chemically made, it has become hazardous to our farming communities because of not using the protective gears which are supposed to be used and other things related to that. Now this one will require you to use technology which is high technology. It can only help the elevated farmers, but not the majority of the small-scale farmers, in my own opinion. Whether it is in an app, whether it is what, have not even attempted, regardless of those levels where you can speak and reach. So indeed, it is a timely technology, but it may not be appropriate now.
Right. What can we do then to make it accessible to farmers? What do farmers need? Because a majority of farmers in Africa are actually small-scale farmers. And if you look at the average age, they also tend to be quite progressed in age, 60 years onwards.
There are a lot of things which are needed. Because AI does not work when there isn't internet, and even the internet connectivity is still not very strong. So first of all, is about the infrastructure development through our government. Then secondly, there's a need of sensitization, awareness creation, but also to create avenues of training the youth, because we are saying, why are youth shying away from agriculture? Because it's not sex-friendly to them. So maybe this could be an entry point for bringing back the youth to agriculture to love it, since there will be other easier ways of managing like pests and diseases, and also other ways of selling, marketing, that kind of thing. But also establishment of centers, an access point where farmers could go. Funding is also a big problem. You know that the agriculture sector, where we fall, as farmers fall, has lagged behind in most of our states. The budget is too small. You can look at the ICT development, where they would have put more money to cater for such, you know, technologies that has been underfunded. So if those one are addressed, maybe we can have a stepping stone to start on and making sure that this one works for them, to make sure that AI is also part of our farming system.
Do you think technologies like AI would be effective in Africa? And if so, how soon?
In Africa, a farming has been regarded as a last resort. That's where we get challenges. When you look at who are into the farming sector, majority have been literate or semi-literate. We need to broaden ways of how do we educate people in the use of technology to handle such gadgets and use them.
Talk to me about then how you're dealing with climate change and the impact of climate change on food production. How has that changed how the farmers that you work with operate?
Climate change is a big thing. For us, we say we want climate justice. We in Africa, we are the lowest contributor to this calamity of this, the climate change. But again, we suffer the consequences more than the one who it. So we've looked at various avenues and we identified that increased use of conventional way of farming cannot calm down the climate change. We think that through agroecological production, there are very many chances of helping our mother earth cool back to 0.5 degrees and restore the ecosystem loss, ecosystem which is being depleted. But also friendly way of working on earth and also the reduction on other things which can lead to deforestation and also making sure that we propose solutions which are appropriate and are friendly and easily accessed and used by the majority of the farmers. These are some of the other ways which we are termed agroecological and agroecologically friendly and workable. So when we look at the whole broader approach, which is restoring the order of the day, how we our farming, looking at the mother earth and the ecosystem at that.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you for calling.
Hakim Balirayne, chairperson of the Eastern and Southern Africa Farmers Federation. And that's Focus on Africa. The producers were Rob Wilson and Bella Hassan in London. Frenny Joey supported them from Nairobi. Connie Sharp oversaw our efforts and Johnny Hall was a technical producer. Alice Muthengi and Andre Lombard are the editors. I'm Charles Vitonga. We'll talk again next time.
Ich bin noch nicht fertig.
Und jetzt?
Sekündchen.
Oh, Papa.
Nein, dauert noch.
Oh, also bei Onkel Rudi ist immer schon gemäht.
Mit Mähen fertig sein, bevor die Kids spielen wollen? Damit's funktioniert, Husqvarna. Erstelle mit der Connect-App eigene Routinen. So ist dein Husqvarna-Mähroboter fertig, bevor deine Kids in den Garten wollen. Entdecke jetzt echte Innovation und Aktionsangebote für Mähroboter auf husqvarna.de oder bei deinem Husqvarna-Fachhändler. Get it right. Husqvarna.
17 members of Zambia's national football squad have been killed in an air crash. The players were on their way to Senegal for a World Cup game.
When disaster struck Zambia's national football team in 1993, many thought that was the end of the country's international football dreams.
These guys had a desire to take us to the World Cup.
The whole country was mourning.
Instead, it was the beginning of one of sport's greatest comeback stories.
We have to go on. We can't give up. We don't give up in Zambia.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service presents the four-part series, Copper Bullets. Listen now by searching for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.